one voice message that I've gotten from a journalist in Gaza, like, if you could hear what people have said and what this means to them, like, that's worth more to me than anything I did with Reuters.
Whenever they present the reporting by Palestinian journalists, it always comes with a caveat, right? Like, we couldn't independently verify this or that,
right,
or this came from...
Palestinians are biased, we're not, right? Here in the
exactly.
West, like, people like me, we come with this open mind of unbiased neutrality, we see the facts and we tell people the truth, but no, in Palestine,
right,
they're compromised. There has to be a footnote and a caveat, and we can't rely on them to tell us what they're seeing.
Exactly. And they're the ones seeing it. They're the ones living it. They're the ones experiencing it. You've been to Gaza. What was that experience like? Okay, so my next guest is Valerie Zink. For 8 years, she worked as a photojournalist for Reuters. But amid Israel's genocide in Gaza and the targeting of Palestinian journalists on the ground, she decided she could no longer stay silent. And so Valerie publicly resigned. She accused Reuters of enabling Israel's killing of Palestinian journalists in Gaza, pointing to the way the agency has repeated Israeli military talking points, including baseless claims about Al Jazeera's Enes Sharif, who was killed alongside five of his colleagues in Gaza City. Days later, five more journalists, including a Reuters cameraman, Hossam al-Masri, as well as my colleagues at Middle East Eye, Mohammed Salama and Ahmed Abu-Aziz, were killed in an Israeli double-tap strike on Nasser Hospital. For Zink, that was the final straw. And that's exactly what we're going to speak to her about. My name is Mohammed Hashim, and this is Real Talk. And she's here, Valerie Zink. Thank you so much for taking the time to be on Real Talk.
Thanks so much for having me, Mohammed. I really appreciate it.
No, I appreciate you, and I appreciate your time. But where do I even start? I mean, there's a lot for me that I can ask right now, but let me just quickly kind of gather your reflections upon this moment over the last, you know, week or so, since everything have kind of developed for you, since you posted that your the picture of you quitting and your decision to resign Reuters with the picture of you cutting the press card in half, the Reuters press card. How you've been processing all of this?
I mean, I certainly wasn't prepared for the response that it's had. I mean, I thought that I would post it to my few hundred friends on Facebook and that would kind of be the end of it. I mean, certainly wasn't expecting the response from people in Palestine, from journalists in Palestine, thousands of messages. I think, to be honest, it just speaks to the level of abject abandonment that people are feeling right now, that this, what I consider a fairly insignificant act has had the meaning that it's had for people. I'm glad that it has, but it's definitely not anything that I anticipated and honestly makes me feel like it was long overdue.
Mm-hmm. Well, if I can even get a little, just to get your thoughts on this, because I was thinking about this before we started our interview. I mean, yesterday, at the time of us recording this, yesterday, the world's top genocide scholars association says that, you know, they've said that Israel is committing genocide in Gaza. And so as, you know, you kind of read this and you're like, okay, well, what else is left for Western media outlets and Western newsrooms to kind of take a more substantial stance and a more substantial stand, I should say, in the sense of there's very few stones left unturned at this point. And I still think we still hear the rhetoric that's coming out in the sense of, you know, genocide is still a controversial word, or, you know, the fact that we're waiting for some sort of decision by the courts and before we kind of allude to it in that way or label it in that sense. So I don't know, what are your thoughts in terms of where Western newsrooms are right now?
I mean, I think that there are shifts certainly that I see in Canadian media. It's gotten, there's a change. I mean, it's not enough of a change and it's 2 years too late. I mean, it's decades too late, depending on how you look at it. But there is a shift there now that I think that the genocide is undeniable. And I think the, you know, forced starvation in particular has really impacted. I just see it in my day-to-day life. The people who've never brought this up in conversation with me before are impacted by this in a way that they haven't been. So, I mean, there's a bit of a shift, but, you know, not enough. We're still seeing the same headlines that are essentially, you know, following this template of Israel fabricates a lie to justify its latest war crime or crime against humanity. And that's picked up as a headline, you know, or a euphemism, like we're continuing to see, you know, relocation of people in Gaza to another country, you know, these terms, this language that makes it seem like, you know, perfectly normal, appropriate, or inevitable. We're still seeing that. And I mean, what will it take? I mean, there's nothing left. I agree with you. There's nothing left. I mean, I think I've felt that way for a long time now. We, you know, it feels like every day is the most, you know, like the heights of depravity are, you know, more than I could have ever imagined possible. And then you wake up the next day and it keeps getting worse, right? Beyond what I could have ever conceived of. And yeah, you know, I was listening to a friend of mine interviewed yesterday talking about Israel's innovation and depravity, right? Israel prides itself as this tech innovator and, you know, medical technology and all that. But I think what it's going to be remembered is the innovation and depravity, you know, the things that we could have never conceived of, like, you know, baiting starving kids with flour and like sniping them in the head, you know, or like using recordings of toddlers crying in distress to bait people out of their homes. Like this, you know, if that's not enough, I mean, yeah, like I literally can't conceive of what is left at this point.
And if we were to kind of go back to your decision to publicly resign in the way that you did, you know, was there a moment, and obviously we're talking about a period of 2 years here, but when did you come to that decision? When did you feel like, was there a specific moment? I know you mentioned the killing of Anas al-Sharif in your statement, but how were you coming to terms with that decision? Was it just slowly leading up to it? Was it just the news of, let's use Anas for example, was it the news of Anas's killing as the breaking point? How what was your thinking process throughout all this?
Yeah, I mean, I guess the short answer is that was the breaking point for me. It's something that I thought about a number of times. But just as far as context, you know, I mean, I've been involved in different ways in the movement for the liberation of Palestine for a long time now. I'm not unbiased. I don't subscribe to the idea of journalistic neutrality. I have an opinion about genocide. I have an opinion about occupation.
Can I say why do you think that that's important? Because this is actually an important note. Why do you feel the need that I don't subscribe to the idea of journalistic neutrality? Why is this important right now?
Well, that prevails in, you know, mainstream Western media, right? That's the expectation. And I mean, on that note, actually, I used to work for Canadian Press briefly as a stringer as well. I just started in 2003 and I was contacted by my editors there, you know, I think the first week of November in 2023, just a couple of weeks into the genocide after I'd been involved in a protest calling for a ceasefire. And they called me to say, it was kind of a series of phone calls going up the chain of command, basically telling me that it was a bad look for Canadian Press and that they wouldn't be giving me assignments indefinitely, right? Because I, you know, couldn't come to the work in an unbiased, even though I've never covered anything related to Palestine. I've never.
Right. You don't even cover the Middle East.
No. And people, you know, I hate to disappoint people because I think that there's this impression, you know, in the thousands of messages that I've received over the last week, there's this impression that I was the person in the newsroom writing these headlines for deeply immersed in its coverage of Gaza. And that's not the reality. I mean, I'm a nobody freelancer in Western Canada, you know, and
I mean, I wouldn't say nobody though, Valerie.
I mean, like in the hierarchy of writers, like, sure. You know, like I'm in the dust, you know, and that's fine. I mean, it's okay. I'm just being, you know, transparent about this, right? I've never had any connect, and I don't say that to absolve myself. It's just, that's the fact. I've never been involved in any of their coverage of the Middle East. And what I do feels very far removed from that for the most part. And, you know, throughout these last 2 years, I've done everything that I know how on a grassroots level, you know, to increase, like to mobilize pressure on the Canadian government for an arms embargo, to impose sanctions on Israel. I've been involved in divestment campaigns against Canadian banks investing in Israeli weapons manufacturer. And, you know, that's kind of been my focus. And the Reuters thing was in the background. Like, I really need to just contact my editors and tell them where I'm at right now. But
So you attended a protest in November, and this is at a time when you had a job with Canadian Press. And
I was a stringer. So, you know, to be clear, I was not an employee. I was a stringer.
A stringer is basically like a freelancer, right?
A freelancer. So it basically means that you're their person, you know, in Southern Saskatchewan. If there's news in that area, you're the person that they go to cover that. But there's no.
And despite that, despite the fact that you weren't even staffed, they felt it was necessary to cut ties because you just attended a Gaza solidarity protest.
And I pushed them on it and I said, you know, can you share with me your policy around neutrality, or can you share? And then they essentially said, well, you're not an employee, so that doesn't apply to you.
Can I ask you this?
Am I being held to a higher standard than your employees? But they, you know, they didn't want to share with me any. It was just kind of, no, you're, you know, they said we won't contact you indefinitely. And that's been the case. And I'm fine with that. I don't want to work for anyone who has a problem with me opposing genocide. You know, I mean, it wasn't, people said like, oh, this must be a hard decision. These are not hard decisions. It's, you know, it's good riddance as far as I'm concerned.
Can I ask you this though, Valerie, because let me try to ask you this differently. And I don't know if this has happened to you or any other of your other colleagues at the time, but had you had attended, let's say, a protest in solidarity with Ukraine, do you think Canadian Press's decision would have been the same?
Well, we know the answer to that. And I asked them that on the phone that day. I said, so, you know, if I had been at a rally in support of housing for all, you know, would that mean that I couldn't work for Canadian Press? And they said, yes. You know, I mean, give me a break. We all know that that's not the case, right? And this is the double standard that's applied across the board. You know, I have friends who work in the library system in Vancouver where they've banned staff from wearing keffiyehs, wearing watermelons, like any, you know, Palestinian iconography at all. And the policy is, you know, we don't allow political symbols. But if you wear, you know, a pride flag, if you wear an Every Child Matters pin, you know, if you wear a Ukrainian flag, of course, those are all permitted, right? It's what the policy means is you can't show support for Palestine or Zionists will feel unsafe in the library, right? So, yeah, I mean, that's the Canadian Press story. It's a brief one, but That's part of the context.
Yeah, and to even add to that, Valerie, as far as I know, like at CBC, for example, which is a Canadian public broadcaster, you can't even use the word Palestine. I think that's part of their guideline. Yeah, that's part of their style guide.
As far as I know, that's right. And I mean, CBC is obviously not alone in that. And there was actually a report released by Reuters staff and former staff a couple of weeks ago detailing some of the same sort of policies restricting use of the word Palestine, you know, the regulations around when and how they could use genocide and if, you know, cited in certain contexts and resources allocated to Israeli casualties. I mean, these are, I'm sure all of your listeners are familiar with all of this. But yeah, just going back to your question in terms of the breaking point, I mean, yeah, I had followed Anas throughout the genocide and, you know, kind of seen it coming, I guess, like a lot of us did after he posted that plea for protection from the international community. You know, we saw it coming. I mean, because we've seen this happen so many times before. And, you know, I don't know about you, but I develop a connection with these people. And you're following them every day. You're seeing this through their eyes. And in my day-to-day life, you know, I go and get groceries. I drop my kids off at school or whatever. And I feel, for the most part, a profound alienation from all the people I interact with in my day-to-day life who are just in a different universe right now, right? Like, we're not in the same place. And the people I feel connected to are, you know, on YouTube, they're doing podcasts, on Twitter. I feel like that's been my social world over these last 2 years, with some notable exceptions of close friends and family members and everything. But there's a, you know, I'm like with Abu Bakr, who you had on the show recently, like I feel like I love these people, you know, I do. And like, I have the utmost respect and admiration for them. Like, you know, I said in my statement that these are the best and the bravest journalists to ever live. And I mean, I think that's pretty indisputable personally at this point. But I also think it's true that they're just the best human beings. And, you know, when these assassinations happen, yes, it's killing eyewitnesses to the genocide, is killing our right to know what's happening. It's also just erasing some of the best human beings, I think, that are alive on the planet, people who had a right to live, you know. And that's the part that I really grieve. And reading his final words and testament, I mean, like, I was just weeping. I mean, I don't think I'm the only one, and I kept coming back. I think I've probably read it 15 or 20 times now. It's just, it's so devastating. And, you know, reading what he wrote about entrusting his kids and his, like, these are just beautiful people who deserve to parent their own children, you know. And it's unbearable. I mean, every day is unbearable, you know. And then you see Reuters headline, you know, I forget exactly what, like, Israel's assassinated.
I have it right here, actually. Yeah. Basically, I think that the headline has changed now, but I have the original that it was published. And so it says, this was Reuters on August 10th, 2025. Israel kills Al Jazeera journalist, it says, was Hamas leader.
Yeah. Yeah. And so, you know, you read Anas's final words, and then you see this headline, and, like, my brain just can't contain these. Like, it just breaks your mind, you know. And at that point, I was done. Actually, I made the decision then, but I was visiting family and I didn't have my press pass with me, and told my partner, when you come, can you please bring my press pass? And then I had to wait until he came, because I knew, you know, what this is how the algorithms work. Like, if anyone was going to see, you've got to have an image. And
It was super strong.
But that was the day I decided I'm going to cut it up and I'm going to do this publicly for whatever it's worth. I didn't think much, to be honest. But as a gesture of solidarity, you know, it's what I could do. And so I had to wait until my partner came with my press pass. And then just so happens, you know, then there's another five journalists assassinated at Nasser Hospital. And I'd been working on my statement at that point, and then that happened. And, you know, I knew I had to get it out that day. So that was the breaking point. But, you know, it's in this, it's in a bigger context, I guess. It's not that I, you know, had any illusions about Reuters coverage throughout the genocide. I mean, I'd been vocally critical about it throughout the genocide, you know, not just Reuters, but mainstream media generally. So it's, you know, I hate, it's not like 2 years into the genocide, I had this epiphany or something. I mean, it was a long time coming. It just felt that my work covering local stories here was far removed from it, and me leaving would not be noticed or have any impact. But yeah, I mean, just on principle, at a certain point, I just felt like I can never have anything to do with these people again. I mean, it's over.
And just on that, Valerie, basically the conversations that you were having with colleagues or upper management, or just, I'm not even talking about your decision to resign. I'm just talking about regular conversations over the past 2 years of the genocide. You know, I think a lot of the outrage towards mainstream media is the fact that this isn't, you know, very complicated, which, and the fact is, when you restrict the truth, or you restrict the reporting that's coming out of Gaza through the killing of journalists, the more the Israeli military can act with impunity. It's not hard to kind of look at it from that perspective. And so what were these topics part of the conversations that you were having with former colleagues, with managers, within the, you know, I know you weren't in the newsroom per se, but within the chats?
I basically don't have any Reuters colleagues where I live. You know, sure. I'm the only one in southern Saskatchewan. I was not in touch with management about this. I was talking to other journalists who work for other, you know, media organizations, trying to push them, you know, with varying degrees of success, I guess. Certainly there's no shortage of journalists who are furious right now, who feel, I mean, I've gotten, I can't count how many messages I've gotten from Reuters staff, from other journalists.
What did Reuters staff tell you? What did they say after you posted that?
Well, a few messages from people who were very supportive and said, you know, one guy comes to mind who's working in the States and his visa is connected to his job with Reuters and he hates it and he hates them and he wants to leave, but he can't leave without leaving the States and like aborting his entire life. And, you know, so there's obviously a lot of privilege that enabled me to make the decision that I did, and not everybody, you know, the sacrifices are different for different people depending on where they are and their circumstances. I'm part of this Facebook group called the Vulture Club that's basically people looking for fixers in different places. I posted it there when I shared it, to, you know, just initially, just like, oh, these are media people, journal, like, they may as well read it. And again, you know, mostly all entirely supportive. One senior, you know, veteran Reuters photographer who said, like, I'm sorry, Valerie, who, you know, that was his response.
Really?
And yeah. And like, you know, and I said, I mean, I'm not pretending to be anyone than I, you know, anyone other than who I am. But
it's funny that that person was knocking you instead of looking at the stand.
He was knocking me, and he, you know, he said, we're all grieving, we're all outraged, but what you did was obscene. To, you know, accuse your Reuters colleagues. You know, I'm actually not, if you read the statement, I'm not actually accusing colleagues.
It's the organization.
This is about, you know, it's the organization. It's about editors and management, right? I'm not saying that, you know, journalists are trying their damnedest to make this better. Many of them are. And actually, I was contacted by a number of people who have quit their position, you know, with CNN and with CBC, for the same reasons. And it, you know, for whatever reason, the algorithm didn't pick it up, right? But it's, I think, more common than we realize.
Yeah. And what do you think? I think for those who do stick with the organizations at the end of the day, I think there are basically two camps that I think of here. There's one camp, like, similar to the one that you just mentioned, whether you have a colleague or a journalist who is very much against the policy of the organization, but their lives are tied to it because of, you know, whatever it is, a mortgage or a visa or whatever it is. And then there's others who, I don't know if that's more, I don't know if that's lessened over the last while, but then there's others who believe that they can have a shot at changing the policy from the inside by staying inside the organization. I don't know. What do you make of that?
Oh, I mean, it's the same, you know, the same conversations that happen about, you know, people who run for office and think they can change things, you know, working in the system. I mean, this exists in all of these institutions, right? And I mean, that's never been my approach. I mean, I agree with the idea that ultimately it's a system that changes you, right? And that's what we see with journalists. That's what we see with elected officials, you know. By and large, there are some exceptions, but just look at the facts, right? It hasn't been successful, right? There are a few stories that get through. Usually then there's a retraction, you know, the Globe and Mail, the major daily here in Canada, just issued a retraction for using the term forced separation. You saw that, right?
Yeah, actually,
because that would imply blame, right? That would be actually reporting on, you know, who has agency over this and the facts of the matter. But no, it's a humanitarian crisis. There are many factors. No, you know, there's no aggressor here. There's no one to point your finger to.
It was being reported that also Honest Reporting this happened after basically a campaign from Honest Reporting, which many viewers may not know is basically a pro-Israel watchdog.
Yeah.
In Canada, similar to like Canary Mission and Beitar.
Yeah, I'm sure that there are equivalents in the States and elsewhere. I'm not familiar with what they are, but a friend of mine, Sean Tucker, has been doing a lot of work on Honest Reporting Canada. They have charitable status in Canada. They're a registered charity, incredibly, right? And essentially they they incite campaigns of harassment and intimidation against journalists who run anything nominally critical of Israel, right? Who are then, you know, then they receive a deluge of thousands of threatening messages, messages threatening their personal safety, the safety of their family, you know, racist messages, just abusive, hateful vitriol to punish people, right? And then they, of course, contact their employers and you know, say that this person doesn't deserve to have this position, you know, and people are afraid for their livelihood. And it's effective. A lot of times it is, right? And people begin to self-censor. They take the path of least resistance. And yeah, and then at the editorial level, you see these retractions and apologies. And, you know, and this is all done through, like, publicly funded tax breaks in Canada, and many other Zionist organizations, you know, who are also in the same position of being registered as a charity, right, for public good, allegedly.
So you've spoken to me about the positive messages that you've received since posting your resignation. What about the negative ones? What negative ones have you received? Do you feel like you've been placed in a position that kind of jeopardizes your professional relationships?
You know, you probably won't even believe me when I say this, but there's been essentially no negative message. I haven't read all the comments. There are thousands of comments on Twitter and Facebook, and I haven't actually read any of those. Maybe a smattering. I've tried to read all of the individual messages that people have sent me. For the most part, I've read all of them and responded as best as I could. So I don't know what's in the comments, I'm sure. I've seen a few that are, you know, along the lines of, oh, you know, good, one less, you know, pro-Hamas journalist, that kind of thing. But I haven't received any negative messages personally, other than some really patronizing sort of, I know this war is brutal, Valerie, and wars are brutal, but these Hamas people are not your friends. And, you know, there's this kind of, oh, you must be naive, and let me inform you of the reality of how barbaric these people actually are. And, you know, you don't know what you're, you know. So some of that, but honestly, in the past 2+ decades of doing work around Palestine, I've received a lot more hateful messages than I have this last week. It's mostly been overwhelmingly positive.
In your statement, you talk about, you know, having deep shame and grief. And this is also comes at a time when a lot more journalists are being vocal right now, being basically deeply ashamed of the profession right now, in light of this. So how do you look at journalism? And when I say journalism, I mean obviously reporting within Western media outlets, mainstream media outlets in the West, in 2025 right now.
I mean, for me personally, I was obviously willing to torch any future that I had working for Western media, right? I mean, that I did that with eyes wide open. I'm totally unemployable in, you know, mainstream media. That's fine. I mean, I think that one thing I will say is that alternative media has never been better. I think that people are abandoning mainstream media en masse. You know, like, I grew up in a CBC family, okay? Some of my earliest memories are of the family gathering before supper, it's golden hour, the sun's going down on the horizon. I grew up on a farm in rural Alberta, you know.
And Peter Bansbridge about to come on.
Yeah, right? And my dad is hushing me, you know, like World at Six, like this was a sacred time in our household, right? The World at Six, right? And I, that was instilled in me. I've had CBC on in the background my whole adult life, despite myself, just out of force of habit, no matter how terrible it is. I've just, you know, I haven't been able to break the habit. It's just on. It's a comfort thing. But that's over now, right? Like, that was over October 8th. I don't have the stomach for it. And maybe you could argue, and people have argued this with me, you know, we have a responsibility to just know what they're saying, to be aware of it. I can't do it. I can't. I mean, and I don't think my parents don't listen to CBC either now, for what it's worth, right? And alternative media is shining. That's what I'm mostly focused on right now, is all the great work that's being done there. I mean, I'm not saying that they're thriving financially. I know it's always a struggle, and my inbox every day is filled with pleas for financial support from whatever alternative, you know, Patreon or whatever. It's a struggle. There's not a lot of models for how this can be financially, you know, viable long term. It's a struggle. But in terms of the content that they're producing right now and how many people are relying on that, to know what's going on in the genocide. I mean, yeah, that's it's never been better, I think.
But why is it, if I can just kind of expand on this, why is it that you think that these newsrooms are still unable to fully stand in solidarity with their Palestinian colleagues? Like, we've seen strong calls, for example, of them calling for allowing international journalists to go in, international reporters to go into Gaza, which is obviously great. Nobody is going to deny that or want to stand against that, basically, in terms of that support. But you also see the same outlets, the same newsrooms who either collaborate with these Palestinian journalists whenever they present the reporting by Palestinian journalists. It always comes with a caveat, right? Like, we couldn't independently verify this or that,
right,
or this came
no,
from...
Palestinians are biased. We're not, right? Here in the
exactly.
West, like, people like me, we come with this open mind of unbiased neutrality. We see the facts and we tell people the truth, but no, in Palestine,
right.
They're compromised. There has to be a footnote and a caveat, and we can't rely on them to tell us what they're seeing.
Exactly. And they're the ones seeing it. They're the ones living it. They're the ones experiencing it. So I guess that takes me back to my question is what else is needed for newsrooms to have a stronger stand of solidarity? Or why isn't even that stand isn't happening? Like, we understand where the problem is, right? And you highlighted it in your statement briefly, where you talk about peddling Israeli military talking points, right? I think you called it Israeli propaganda. But that's the problem with how media reporting is presented. But why can't they take a stronger stand in solidarity is what I'm asking here.
I mean, it's a good question. Like, I think that it would be foolish of us to think that these are anything other than like profit-driven capitalist organizations that care about a bottom line more than they care about individual people, right? And will that change with more pressure, more public outrage? It might, but I think the way that they're structured is, you know, they're not structured to care about individual people's lives, right? And that's been honestly the most heartbreaking part of this, is being contacted by the families of journalists who've been killed and talking about their experience, the families of Reuters journalists who've been killed, and how, like, their heartbreak, fury, again, I don't have the language for it, but the total disregard for their family members' lives, you know, and still until this day, right? I don't know if we can expect that to change, honestly.
Can I ask you this then, if we change gears a bit? You've been to Gaza, is that correct?
I have, 20 years ago, almost
right.
Exactly, yeah.
What was the, and you've been to the West Bank as well, but since we're talking about Gaza, what was that experience like?
Yeah, I was in the West Bank in 2003 and in Gaza and the West Bank in 2005. I was there volunteering as a medic with the Red Crescent. And, you know, it was kind of a strange time, to be honest. It was right after the disengagement when all of the settlements were evacuated.
Right. It was before the blockade, the Israeli blockade.
Yeah, exactly. And so very different context than 2003 when I was in the West Bank at the height of the Intifada, you know, with curfew.
The second
constantly
one.
Constantly in closure. Yeah, second Intifada. So a very different time. I was just thinking about it recently because someone contacted me from Gaza who was asking if I'd ever been there. And we were chatting. I said, you know, I was there right after the disengagement. And he was talking about what a beautiful time that was, because he was one of those kids who, you know, looked out his window at the sea, could smell the sea in the air, and was forbidden from ever going there. And he was telling me how he would go to sleep at night hearing settlers dancing and having parties on the beach. And one of the things that I did when I was in Gaza is work at these pop-up medical tents that the Red Crescent set up along the beach, because all these kids like him who, you know, had like lived right, you know, like a literal stone's throw from the sea their whole lives, could finally access it for the first time, and were just running into the water and didn't know how to swim. And there were all these problems with near drownings as kids were just, you know, flooding into the sea. So, you know, it was a different kind of experience than being there a couple of years earlier. I felt pretty useless medically, to be totally honest, with very, very limited Arabic. I didn't feel terribly useful in that respect. In the West Bank, it's a bit different because just having a Canadian passport, it changes things, right? In terms of the ability of ambulances to get through checkpoints, the likelihood of them being targeted, just having a presence there. This was at the time when there were a lot of protests against the construction of the apartheid wall. I attended a lot of those. They were obviously, peaceful, unarmed protests that were met with live ammunition and violence, as is the case always. So I attended a lot of those demonstrations.
So how has that trip changed you, or what did you carry? What did you go away with, basically, when you came back to Canada, or when you went back to Canada?
Honestly, rage. I got a lot of rage. I was there for 3 months, particularly in 2003, to be honest. So 3 months, it's enough time to really gain an appreciation of what it means day to day to live under occupation and the daily degradation and humiliation and violence that people live with filled me with rage. But also, it was life altering. It was formative for sure. And the relationships that I, left there with, are incredibly meaningful to me. And the way, I just felt like you see the absolute best and worst of humanity, right? And I think we're still seeing that now in the genocide, right? Like the way that Palestinians are in that, like the generosity, my God, like it was unbearable to me, you'd walk down the street and have, a dozen people inviting you in for dinner. And then you'd go and they cooked for 3 days and they would take, embroidery that they'd worked on for months and give it to you after knowing you for 10, like it was just excruciating generosity and kindness and beauty. And then you go to a checkpoint and I just filled with rage. That's what I left with. I think that's probably stuck with me. I'm easily enraged. And just, I think, a sense of urgency. I don't know. It's hard to summarize, I guess.
No, it is. It is. And actually, thank you for delving into that. But let me ask you this then. If there was a journalist right now, basically, who's in the same shoes you were weeks ago, kind of on the fence, not knowing, what decision to take, they feel outraged as you are right now, and they want to take some sort of stance, but they're also scared of making that jump or taking a drastic decision that would change their lives, perhaps. But what would you tell them if they were listening to you right now?
Honestly, I would say that like one voice message that I've gotten from a journalist in Gaza, like if you could hear what people have said and what this means to them, like that's worth more to me than anything I did with Reuters. Like what you gain from standing behind people and what that means to them, it's just, it wasn't a difficult decision for me. I guess I'll say it was the right decision, and that's been validated in how people have responded. I never would have anticipated what it's meant to people who are just desperate for anyone to do anything, and the level of exasperation and fury that people feel toward these media outlets now for their culpability in enabling this to continue. And normalizing it, things that used to be shocking to us, Israel used to have to lie, and now they just, we bombed a hospital, right? Like we see how this has changed over the course of this year. What's acceptable now, right? And that's horrifying to me. And I think that will permeate well beyond the boundaries of Palestine, right? That has implications in a much broader way. So, I don't know. I can't counsel anyone to torch their career or anything, but certainly in my experience, it's been profoundly humbling and rewarding to connect with all the people who've reached out to me over the past week.
Have any Palestinian, you said you got a voice note from Gaza, so have you been in touch with any Palestinian journalists? And I'm just curious of what you were telling them, what they were telling you, if that was the case.
Yeah, I have. I'm honestly kind of embarrassed to be thanked for my courage and brave. Like, it's unbearable to me, right? From these people living in, like, it's a joke, right? Nothing that I've done in my whole life is as brave as, you know, waking up and deciding to live another minute in Gaza right now, right? And all these people reaching out to me to thank me in the most sincere way, like using language that is, you know, more beautiful than anything I ever encounter in my day-to-day life here, right? I mean, like, the most eloquent messages. I don't know how to respond. I do my best to respond to people in a heartfelt way, but that's been most of it, is just people thanking me. I guess the other side of it is, you know, the number of people who are asking for my help in ways that, unfortunately, like, I just don't have the power to, like, you know, help if journalists who want my help evacuating right now, or families of journalists who've been killed who are trying to connect with families living overseas and evacuate to join my cousins or uncles in the UK or whatever. Like, this, that's been the hardest part, is people thinking that I have some influence and power that I don't have, you know, and having to let people down and not say, like, yeah, no,
it's,
like,
a tough position.
There's nothing that I can do for you, you know.
It's a tough position to be in. But you know what? Tell you what, I can't thank you enough for the time you've given us with this conversation. I even went overboard a little bit, and genuinely, I wish you nothing but the best of wishes and luck over the next period as you navigate, you know, this experience and this moment in your life. And I look forward to coming out west when I'm back in Canada. Wonderful. so we can meet.
Yeah, let's do that. You're welcome.
Thank you so much, Valerie, and thank you for your time. I appreciate you coming on Real Talk.
Thanks for having me.